This podcast was recorded at the 2009 CUPE National Convention.
Okay, delegates, I'm going to ask Brother Claude to come back. We have a very special guest that Claude is going to introduce. So I'd ask you to, if you're going out, do so quietly. And I'll turn the microphone back to my brother, Claude.
Thank you. I'll switch back in French. J'aimerais bien présenter Michel dans l'une des langues.
I would like to introduce Michelle in one of the languages that she speaks fluently. There's French, for example, and as a member of the great nation, she has others. The Abenaki, for example. She has a few languages. Anyway, I'll introduce her in French. She works to defend native rights and has been doing so for more than 25 years. She's a producer and a moderator at on a TV news bulletin at Télé-Québec, Bulletin des Nations, it's in TFO and TV Ontario, and also on the RDI News World or CBC-type network. She presents conferences and workshops everywhere in the world in order to get a native condition or status or talk about their conditions. And she talks about women's rights and young people's rights. And in 1992, the government of Quebec recognized her work by awarding her with the Justice Award. And she also received the Rights and Liberties Award from the Human Rights Group. So she represents Native women in Quebec. She was the president from 87 to 92. And she was quite a militant. And I think you will learn something from her today with regard to what we want to develop about our own activism. So in Ottawa Valley, in Abitibi-Miscamang, she also got a PhD honoris causa. So I'd like to get her to take the floor right now at this conference. Please, a warm welcome to Michelle Rouleau.
Bonjour. Good morning.
Good morning. Kwikwe, I watch ya.
Warm welcome to my brothers and sisters from the different First Nations from this elsewhere in Canada. Bienvenue. I will be speaking to you in French. So for those of you who don't understand French, I'm sorry, you will have to wear your earmuffs.
First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me here to speak to you today. This is a real honor for me to speak to you. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about a reality that is too often unknown, and that is the reality of the First Nations, to understand our contemporary reality and our demands. You need to have some historical knowledge. Unfortunately, in this country, the history that has been taught to us was cleaned up with some bleach. It made it whiter than white. The history is whiter than white. And in this wonderful white history, the country was discovered by white people, colonized by white people, developed by white people. The Indians who lived here were useful to some extent, but unfortunately, they quickly became invisible. Of course, I'm making a caricature here, but it remains that in many ways, the history of Canada that is being taught today in the schools is a big legend, a myth where the white people who came to these shores are the heroes and the Indians are the evil ones. So that's not quite the reality of the First Nations. That's why I'm taking this opportunity today to give you a few historical pointers from the point of view of the bad Indians. So here's my very shortened version of our history. Long ago, on a territory that is now called Canada, there were organized native cultures. Some nations were nomadic, others were sedentary. these nations had their operating rules, the rules for occupying the territory, and rules for cohabitation. The First Nations had commercial relationships with the Europeans at first, to sell whale oil first and then for the fur trade. When the fur trade was in decline, the Indians were no longer needed, but the Indians' lands were needed. The new powers took over the territory, and the relationship with the First Nations began to change. Little by little, the First Nations became dependent on the state. Following that, to manage the business of people that they called the savages, the new governments put up strategies. They adopted laws that had names like the Act to Encourage Gradual Civilization of Savage Tribes, or the Act Concerning Civilization of Savages. The Canadian Confederation in 67 got the exclusive right over the native people, and from 1876 the Indians got a minor citizenship status, and it became a wardship. The natives could no longer decide for themselves. Even today, 140 years later, this is the act that dictates how native communities will manage their affairs. And the only person having authority over that law is the Minister of Native Affairs. The act says who's an Indian. The Indian Act says who's an Indian, who's one, who's not one. Defines under the Section 6 of the law that there are different types of categories of native people. When you're when you're a registered Indian, you register at two places, at the registrar and at what the minister called at the tribe. We have a tribe number or a band number. Now we get into the universe of the law or the act concerning Indians. There's bands, because they never use the word nation. They talk about band. They talk about band council, reserve, number, register Indian. In category 6-1, 6-2, reinstated 631s. The 631s are mainly women who were reinstated under the C-31 Act, a bill that amended the Indian Act in 1985. Up to that date, 12-1B, Section 12-1B stipulated that an Indian woman who married a non-Indian lost her native status, an Indian status. For a woman to lose her legal Indian status meant also that she was chased away from her community and denied by her family. Women had to work long and hard to repair that injustice. At the time, there were women like Mary Two Axe Early, who was a Mohawk from Kahnawake, who founded the Equal Rights Movement for Native Women. And it was at that time that the Native Women Associations were formed throughout Canada. Other women also went to the courts. The first was Jeanette Cormier Lavelle, who contested the discrimination against her by the Indian Act, because she lost her status because she married a non-Indian. In 1973, she lost her court case in Supreme Court. The judges considered that she was not being discriminated against because, according to them, she had improved her lot in life by marrying a white man. In 1981, Sandra Lovelace from Tubic brought her cause to the United Nations Human Rights Tribunal. Their decision had no legal impact, but was a moral victory over the Indian Act. And finally, after many years of struggle, in 1985, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Liberties, and especially Section 15 on the rights to equality, obliged the Canadian government to change the Indian Act. The C-31, which gave status to women that they lost because they married a non-Indian, and their first generation of children were reinstated. These women were reinstated. Bill C-31 had its own set of complicated, and the positions to the change were very strong, and the opposition to that thing were very strong and even violent in some communities. Politically, it was a lot. It was mainly that this struggle was led out of Quebec because Quebec's Native women were at the heart of this debate. And let me tell you that that was a really challenging part of history, and it's not even settled yet today. Many problems are still there, and women have to continually oppose the discrimination that they are subject to under the Indian Act. And unfortunately, in the First Nations, some people have adopted this mentality of this Indian Act. They practice discrimination among ourselves. We discriminate according to the Indian status, looking at the person's skin color or where they live. With the Indian Act, there was the creation of the reserves. And today, we can note that what are the results of that, of those absurd policies and regulations. Most Native communities today have to deal with serious social problems. Of course, those communities are not all the same. There are differences from one community to the next, from urban communities, rural communities, and remote communities. We understand that there are communities that can manage very well, but others are left out, and the lives of those people have nothing to envy about them. The background is pretty somber. These Native communities have a 5 to 10 times higher suicide rate than the national average. Many have to deal with violent situations, sexual abuse, and drug and alcohol addiction, as well as gambling addiction. Family violence in Native communities takes different forms: physical and sexual aggression, psychological aggression, negligence, and financial exploitation. Although there's a whole immobilization around this to counter this, it is still very present and too present. It is even becoming more surreptitious, or there's a new form of violence now that's a mysterious type of violence that's spreading like the plague. Disappearances of young women. Is it normal that in a country like Canada, so many young women should disappear without the authorities becoming more concerned, and that the media don't even talk about it? To come back to violence in communities, some experts say that it would be like a civilized country to turn on its own. We look at the source of the problem. We talk about it. We try to change things. But there's still resistance out there. We understand there's violence in our communities. We understand the causes, but doesn't excuse it. We must never excuse violence. And we should never And especially, we should never say that it's a cultural thing or that it's a traditional thing. Violence is unacceptable. We must not tolerate it in any case, in any shape or form. We must end it before it destroys future generations. We already have a generation that was marked by the boarding school experience, where 150,000 Native children were sent, where several were victims of negligence, physical and sexual abuse. It's not all Native people who had undergone this and who had bad experiences, not all of them. But once that being said, it should not prevent us from recognizing this dark part of Canadian history. Their wound goes deep. their lives in the Native communities is affected by the fact that they were at those boarding schools. And we see the impact of the intergenerational effect on their children. And the government has recognized it. In June, the Prime Minister apologized to the First Nations, but the Catholic Church decided not to apologize, and the Pope issued a small statement of regret. We had to talk about a pension for them and a fund for them to make up for the problem, but we're far from a true reconciliation. We cannot stop thinking about what's happening to us today. It's the result of 300 years of colonization. This is what you get when you dispossess a people of their lands, their language, their culture, their mode of living, when you put people under tutelle, when you make them into children, when you take away their agency. Some people don't like to talk about this, when you disempower them. It's hard to ignore, however, history and ignore the fact that this country was built on the backs of these first inhabitants and that they are dispossessed and they have no control over their own lives. Today, the challenge facing the First Nations is tremendous. Rebuild societies that were excluded and impoverished. There's so much to do. We aspire to a better life for ourselves and our children. And for that, we have to see to improving the life conditions of our families. We need housing. We need adequate infrastructure. We need access to drinking water. We need health and social services resources. Economically, we need innovative projects, jobs, qualified labor. We have to aim at sustainable development that respects the environment. To fully participate in the development of our First Nations, young people need access to education. They need to be encouraged. They need to be given hope. They need positive role models to feel that they have a place in society. We must ensure the protection, survival of our language and culture. The First Nations cannot develop economically, culturally, and socially without having access to resources and territories, the territories that they used to occupy. We have to find a balance between our communities and our societies. For survival, the First Nations need all the energies that they can get from the communities and outside the communities. This new society that we want will have to be different than others, not through rhetoric and statements and declarations, but by actions. Our leaders need to give the example and have to follow an ethics code together and within the relationship with the First Nations. The discussion must be open and inclusive. Citizens must be encouraged to participate. At the same time as we affirm the collective rights of the First Nations, we must commit to its respecting human rights of individuals. These are not in opposition, but they are complementary to each other. For governments, it is time to recognize the legitimacy of the First Nations. In this regard, the statement of the UN adopted in September 2007 on the rights of Native peoples is the key to establishing a new relationship. This declaration asserts that Native peoples have the right to self-determination and that by virtue of that right that they should freely determine their own political status and freely ensure their own economic, social, and cultural development. To date, 144 countries have supported this statement. Only 3 countries have refused to sign. New Zealand, United States under Bush administration, by the way, and Canada. The United States are going to review their position. Mr. Harper, however, is playing piano. Of course, these are very complex questions, and we cannot hope for any quick solutions. But the governments have the responsibility to make sure that things move forward. Crises and conflicts are expensive. They're costly, way more costly than negotiated political agreements. Winning conditions for harmonious relationships means that we need the will and the courage of our real policies. Our relationships are also complex. It's not always easy to live together, to cohabit. You need a lot of confidence among peoples, in the public, in the, among the population, to have mutual respect. And to have mutual respect and everything that is needed, we need to know each other. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of ignorance and prejudice when it comes to native people. We have a lot to do to get to know each other. We can no longer live in indifference, be indifferent to each other. We need events that assemble us. We need events that bring us together. We need events and projects also that rally us, that bring us together, that where we must work in partnership. We need to work together, native people and non-native people, to create ties so that we get to know each other better and that we develop solidarities. In this respect, I just want to mention the work carried out by CUPE. Your action shows your commitment to the rights of the First Nations of this country. Whether it be in an urban setting or in the communities, there are men and women who work for improving the citizens' living conditions. They show energy and creativity. They need your solidarity, the people in those communities who are trying their best to do what they can. There are also men and women who struggle to protect our resources, our lakes, our rivers, and our forests. They need your solidarity. There are also men and women who believe in nonviolence, social justice, and democracy. They need your solidarity. We are living on Mother Earth together. Our destinies are joined. We need each other. We need to be in solidarity. Together, we can ensure a better future. Together, we can ensure a better future for the future generations. And who knows? Maybe we can change the course of history. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Michelle. And Michelle doesn't know Brian Barron, our diversity vice president representing our membership of Aboriginal ancestry. And it'd be very, very pleasant to take a moment and recognize and thank Michelle with the help of Brian.
Delegates, please join in me in a round of applause for those words of wisdom, never more appropriate for this time in history. Thank you, Michelle.
This podcast was recorded at the 2009 CUPE National Convention.